Do you want to make your money work harder? Claro is a digital financial coach that helps you to make smart financial decisions and achieve your goals. Claro combines spending analysis, goal setting, saving, and investing tools with one-to-one financial coaching to create a bespoke plan that helps you save and invest with confidence and reach your financial goals. So if you want to grow your money and build for your future, sign up for early access at claromoney.co.uk/raisethebar. Hello and welcome to Raise the Bar. I'm Frankie Cotton and this is the weekly podcast that explores how to make our economy, businesses and work culture more equitable and impactful. This week, I'm absolutely thrilled to have Chloe McIntosh as my guest. Chloe is the co-founder of Made.com, former chief creative officer of Soho House Group, and founder and CEO of Karma, a new sexual wellness app launched in 2020 that was built as a response to the global sex recession. In this episode, Chloe tells us that stress is the number one killer in the world today, but we're not utilizing our body's natural way of combating stress through pleasure. Our culture is so cerebral and head-focused, we buy into phrases like no pain, no gain without examination. But getting into our bodies and becoming present is absolutely essential to both our physical and mental health. Chloe tells us about her experience of raising $3 million of investment for Karma, the surprising reaction of European investors, and how Karma is counterbalancing the tech community's focus on sex with robots. And finally, Chloe tells us what she's learned from building Made.com and how she's consciously incorporating those lessons into Karma. This conversation was recorded on the 7th of April, 2021. I hope you enjoy listening. If you have a view on anything mentioned in this podcast and would like to share it, you can send an email to me at podcast@raisethebar, or you can join in the conversation online by tagging us at raisehq_ on social media. And lastly, if you're enjoying this podcast series, please leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. It helps us to be more visible, which ultimately means we can bring you more interviews like this one. Thank you. Chloe, welcome to Raise the Bar.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here.
Now, Chloe, I'd like to start by asking you, you've said that we're living through a global sex and intimacy recession. What do you think is causing this?
Yeah, we've noticed that since the launch of the iPhone, actually in 2007, and the kind of growth of young people accessing, smartphones, that all of the social markers, so connection, intimacy, you know, relationship, our ability to communicate and connect, have all gone down. And together with that, mental health issues, you know, the sense of isolation, depression has picked up. So it's definitely a correlation between, you know, young people being on the phone. It's so obvious, you know, we know this, but we don't do much about it. And I see really a need for tech companies like myself to really start having a health understanding for the consequences of offering, you know, application and product that is keeping their attention, you know, on that screen. And I'm hoping that as we, you know, realize this further, there will be a sense of responsibility that comes from companies to actually evaluate not just the short-term gain, but the long-term impact of, you know, programs and, you know, platforms which intend to create an addiction really to watching things, and the way that the algorithms are built is actually the more you're there, the more you get followers, you know, the more you post, the more you become relevant. And those programs are actually programming our psyche away from real connection. And I think that's such a terrible issue that is constantly growing and has become even more so during these past 12 months.
And where do you start to even tackle a subject like that? Because it's so just assumed and ingrained in our culture now. You know, we are on our smartphones all the time. We're usually on multiple devices. You know, we arguably live by the algorithms in terms of how we've experienced our relationships. Pretty much this whole past 12 months has been through a filter of an algorithm. How, Chloe, do you even go about starting to tackle this?
Well, I think education is absolutely essential. You know, very often things, you know, evolve in a direction that we don't control. So we become a little bit the victim of situation which takes some inertia. And social media has taken such an incredible inertia in our life that we didn't really have time to assess even if we wanted to, the effect it had on us, you know, maybe you and I are thinking, I don't want this, but yet we are still victim of it. So the first thing is to actually highlight to people the consequences on their mental health, on their ability to connect, on their ability to, you know, understand better what they want. I think there is an issue around the fact that we are drawn towards the thing that other people are presenting to us as desires and wants, and we are disconnected from what we actually really want for ourselves. So I think the first step in that direction, and I think actually this past 12 months have helped creating some realization, is self-care. You know, how do I relate to my own person? What is it that I really want? What is it that makes me feel good? You know, is watching, you know, an hour of social feed, do I feel better or not afterwards? And starting to have realization and education around what is the true impact of those habits. And I find that, you know, we were talking about the sex recession. What has happened is that because most of communication now is nonverbal, you know, because we are not actually building a rapport in the way that we connect with people, we end up with an artificial way that we are evaluating connection and how we want to be communicating. And then when we find ourselves in front of people, we do not know anymore how to create intimacy. You know, it's kind of becoming so difficult. And I think a lot of young people are struggling to evaluate for themselves, what is it that they want? How do they connect? How do they find people that actually is going to make them feel rather better, rather than constantly in a competition with themselves and evaluate it? You know, so much judgment, so much of our experience of life is a reflection of others. And so starting to look inwards and, you know, built a practice, you know, a daily practice where we do take a moment to be with ourselves. You know, I always say that if we don't spend at least an hour with ourselves a day, why are we living? You know, what is the purpose of being here if we do not spend enough time in connection with ourselves? And even though we know this and we've been told this, you know, all the time, the most important thing is your inner connection, we're still struggling to do it. It seems harder to do this than any other social encounter that's available to us.
Yeah. And I wonder then, and perhaps you can tell us a bit about karma, is how is karma working to sort of resolve some of these problems? How are you bringing that level of consciousness and actually the juxtaposition of, you know, like you said, creating the tech to start to solve some of these sort of intimacy and sort of tech related challenges?
Yeah, so actually last month there was a research by the Journal of Sexual Medicine that basically highlighted the benefit of sexual activity on psychological, relational, and sexual health during this past 12 months. And even though at the moment, you know, about 42% of people between 18 and 29 are single, which is, you know, almost half the population is not with a partner, what we don't always think about is that sexual activity does not have to be with a partner. And what Kama is really trying to help people with is finding that connection with yourself through experiencing more pleasure. And this is really important because stress is the number one killer in the world today. It's responsible for more than 60% of all illnesses and disease, right? So this says to us that our mental state is the most important aspect of our overall well-being. And so pleasure is the fastest route to balance, to homeostasis. It's actually what we have in our system as a way to naturally overcome stress. So what we want to present to people is an approach to well-being that's focusing on understanding what makes you feel good. And that's away from external stimulation. That's away from, you know, the influences of others. It's really about being able to find in yourself the things that you find relaxing, that helps you connect, that gives you pleasure. And through that pleasure, we can go back from, you know, a state of alert in the sympathetic nervous system into a parasympathetic state, which is when we rest, restore, and we have sex in that state, you know, rather than rush it in a place of fright and fear. And then we constantly, the system is constantly in alert, not really able to connect and find that peace within yourself. So the idea of a daily practice that is not just about meditation, because meditation is actually quite a hard practice. A lot of people try it, but they don't really succeed, because modern meditation is asking you to sit quietly and not think, which is, again...
which is pretty much impossible for most people if you're going sort of from having never meditated to starting.
Very difficult. And, you know, what's interesting for me to realize is meditation was never intended to be a cerebral exercise. It's a heart-centered practice that is usually embodied. And so because of our very cerebral culture, we intend to bring everything back into our head. And this is where all the issues are. So Kama is a practice that helps you just drop into the body. You know, everything we do is moving the polarized, you know, kind of energetic activity that's around the head and starting to make you connect with your body, your sensation. A lot of our experience of life now is through technology. So we have desensitized our ability to relate to the world through our senses. And it is by reconnecting to those senses and starting to make sense of the world through our senses again, that we can feel present, we can feel connected, and we can find that pleasure.
Yeah, and I totally relate to what you're talking about there, because I think sometimes, especially, you know, with work pressures and other things, and I'd be interested to hear your personal experience, because I imagine you have quite a full-on life as a CEO, right, with stresses of your own, is that you do live a lot of time in your head. And sometimes I think I've forgotten that I even have the rest of my body attached to me sometimes. How do you manage that personally, if you don't mind me asking?
Well, I mean, if I don't do it, then what am I doing here? You know, I'm basically wanting to bring something out into the world that helps people become more embodied. I was not embodied. I believed that I was, because I love dancing, I love moving, and I convinced myself that I was actually living in my body, or at least part of the time. And when I started practicing with some of our experts and learning more about what does it mean, you know, to really be in your body, I realized that my mind was always, you know, driving, you know, situation and taking me through things. And so we really want to switch the mindset from, you know, the no pain, no gain, if you don't suffer, you don't grow kind of model, to we need to be here, present. It's in this present moment that we can actually appreciate life. And so pleasure brings you back to the present moment. So what I practice, and this is really, it could be anything from a quick pelvic floor training, like, you know, a conscious practice where you are with yourself and you exercise, not with a lot of light music, not while being distracted by watching something at the same time as, you know, being on your bicycle, but actually doing a physical practice. That is really definitely a way that you can start experiencing this. So for me, the way I fight it first is I don't go to an office anymore. I don't commute, which is a huge upside to my life before, you know, so there are advantages.
Did you do that because of the pandemic, or was that a choice that you made before then, that you weren't going to commute?
No, you know, the great thing I would say for me in that past 12 months is it's forced me to realize things that I don't think I would have realized otherwise. And one of those things is that actually I enjoy working from home, because when I had children, I was desperate to get out of the house. I kept that mentality that I don't want to work from home. It's just not what I want. It doesn't give me the right rhythm and focus. But obviously being forced, you know, I went to raise money just before the first lockdown. I was lucky enough to close my round just before the first lockdown. So I basically had to rethink how I was going to start this business locked in my house, which means producing all the videos. Everything happened from this place. This house became the center of the world for me, like for a lot of people. And all this kind of centralized, polarized activity, everything was here. And I saw a lot of benefits in this, that I think if we start putting structure, I think the very important thing and what people are missing a lot of the time is that if we are not having the structure forced on us, we've got to create one of our own. And so I have a series of rituals and habits that I really stick to. And they allow me to still feel that there is a structure in my life. And there are things that I, you know, I break the day with some of the practice. I do morning, lunch and evening practice, which are very short. But they just help me to understand how I can live this continuous 24-hour, you know, kind of timeline where not much happens and start creating rhythm. I think if we don't do that, you know, depression can settle. And if you look at actually deeply spiritual people who in monasteries, etc., they have a lot of structure. Structure is really important for your mental well-being. It gives you the reassurance that you are in control, that you can actually make yourself feel good through following, you know, a rhythm of activities which change throughout the day. So I was just very disappointed with the way the government did not offer a lot of solution during this time. You know, as always, we tell us what not to do, but we don't tell us what to do. And there would have been so many incredible initiatives that they could have taken in the way to provide support for people to continue to exercise, for people to have, you know, some form of mindfulness practice, some form of social activity. And we really had to resource everything on our own. You know, it's been a battle for a lot of people to find solution.
Because
there was nothing really offered. There was not a lot of ingenuity and creativity that came out of it from our authorities. And that for me was disappointing. So it meant that, you know, we had to create that ourselves, basically.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I wonder there, you know, as you're talking about lockdown, and I think, you know, lockdown, the three that we've certainly had in the UK, I mean, it has affected our working lives and it's also really affected our relationships. And we sort of fall into two camps for most of us, right? Those who are locked in with our partners and we don't have that normal sort of space and separation that's really important for relationships. And then the other side is those of us who have perhaps been separated from partners or are single and isolated or so on. They're both very different circumstances. But I wonder, from your perspective and the work that you do at Karma, what you can see as ways that we can start to recover from these sort of, and they are habits, you know, the way we relate to each other or the way we communicate, how we can start to recover and heal from what have been very challenging circumstances.
Yeah, so I mean, I've been talking to so many people about that in the past 12 months. Obviously, a lot of what we do is just listening to what people are experiencing and then trying to find a solution to support them. And there is definitely these two groups, you know, people who are on their own and what does that mean for them to even, you know, have the right level of oxytocin, which is our bonding trust hormone, which we usually get through touching others and bonding with others and hugging others and being around other people. So there is a lot of confidence that's been affected and general confidence. And then, of course, sexual confidence, you know, is as a result of this. And this happens both for single people and couples. You know, when you are on your own, you obviously don't have the reassurance and the reaffirmation. You know, you don't get nice comments about how you look and how you feel. You don't have any kind of bouncing from other people. And then when you're a couple, you obviously on top of each other and the lack of space is killing the erotic charge. And then you struggle to actually find that, you know, balance of, you know, I want to connect or I want to have moments on my own. And let alone people who have young children who are living in small spaces. I mean, I can't even imagine what people would have gone through, you know? I mean, it's like, I remember when my kids were young and I just wanted to get out of the house a lot of the time. So I think that we will find that the long-term consequences of what's happened are still to be well understood. We don't really know how it's going to affect us. I think the reconnection into the world, that transition that's happening slowly now, is one that we're focusing on. You know, there's been issues, and during lockdown, we were trying to find solutions for people, trying to explain to them that even though they are on their own, they can actually give themselves that support through self-care, that oxytocin is something you can self-generate, that arousal is something you can self-generate, and reminding people that our technology, you know, this incredible body is extremely self-sufficient. Most of what we need, we can create for ourselves, but we've just lost because we live in a society that creates dependency. A lot of money is made over our insecurities. You know, the more we feel insecure, the more other people are making money on it. So it was really a repairing of our understanding of how autonomous and powerful we can be when we serve ourselves. When it comes to couple, it was actually more around practices and exercise to show people that that sexual tension can come back if we become more intentional with being around each other. You know, when you live with someone, you become best friends. A kiss doesn't really mean anything. A touch doesn't really mean anything. So a lot of what we were talking to couples about is actually don't do that. Start being intentional. You know, book an evening where one of you is going to be looking after the other and only in one direction. You know, become clearer with who is giving, who's receiving, so that there is a sense of trust that, you know, you can recover from someone with that expectation that maybe they want sex, for example, you know, and that's why they're coming towards you. And that intentional practice is one that has the biggest impact on people. They realize that actually when they take a moment to check in and decide, you know, who is this for? And am I in the right state to connect? You know, what am I bringing into this connection? Is this anger, resentment? I just want to do it so I can actually shift my mood? Or should I get myself in the right mindset, do what I need to do for myself, take responsibility for my own arousal, take responsibility for my own pleasure, and then come together to actually bring something positive to the connection?
Yeah, I find it so fascinating, you know, and talking about that sort of independence and also, I guess, how the last 12 months have probably been very painful for a lot of people in various ways. But ultimately, if we can go through that pain, become conscious of those dynamics and those habits, as you're saying, and how they're serving us or not serving us, despite maybe some of the pain and difficulties that we've encountered, hopefully we might be a bit more aware of ourselves and hopefully also our pleasure. But I wonder, for somebody who's perhaps listening to this podcast, Chloe, and thinking, this all sounds wonderful and I would love that, more of that in my life, but I literally cannot find the time, or I'm not prioritizing pleasure. I just can't do it. I have so many pressures. I have, you know, maybe kids and a family and work, and it's just too much. What would you say to them? What is realistic in terms of, you know, that time, that practice that you're talking about?
It's really, again, this idea that if we do not spend time with ourselves, connecting to our desires and what drives us towards life, we will never get better. You know, this is, again, our consumerism. You know, this society has convinced us that what we need is outside of ourselves, that everything that we can, you know, is going to make us happy is what's not, you know, within us. And actually that there's something wrong with us. You know, you think of the work of Sigmund Freud, which has had such an impact on our psyche. We have this subconscious that's conditioning us, and we can't, it's a prison. You know, we're always going to go back into that pattern. This is not true. Neuroscience has proven now that we can write new patterns every day, that new neural pathways are imprinted every day. And it's for us to make the choice as to what direction we want to go. And that bad habits can be transformed into good habits through intentional and repetitive practice. This is something that's now proven by neuroscience, the same way that, you know, meditation came back as a trend because it was proven by neuroscience. It's been around for 4,000 years. Sadly, we need evidence. We need scientific evidence sometimes in order to adopt a change. That's who we've become. So now that those evidence are there, that this is necessary, and, you know, I really truly believe that this past 12 months has been an upgrade, you know, for a lot of people. They may find it a painful upgrade. Most upgrades are painful, but upgrade, that means we actually have a realization that is going to change the way we look at life forever. Mm-hmm. You know, this is kind of what I call as an upgrade. You will never look the same way at situation the way you did before, because that introspective awareness, this ability to look inwards, has been forced upon us, you know, and that is an opportunity to change how we behave in the world. This is the unique chance, you know, when horrible things happen, what we can do is look at what we can learn from it. And this has been such a strong part of my positive thinking and my ability to get through this and fight depression, is that I want to make the best out of this. You know, if I just focus on what didn't work, then it's just not, you know, a way that you can go through this and evolve with it. So what I think has happened, and we see this a lot in sexuality, and especially when it comes to people, you know, around sexual trauma, actually, that when you're not around people, you're not hiding a part of yourself anymore, right? Because we're so used to protecting ourselves. So we go in conversation. We don't really say the full truth. We don't really share our true emotion. When you're on your own 24/7, there's no more hiding. And when we don't hide from others, we don't hide from ourselves. So a lot of people had to face their shadows. They had to face their dark side. But this is a growth opportunity. This is how we change and evolve, you know, from a place of unconscious living to a place of more conscious, you know, behavior. So I'm an extreme optimistic person. You know, I see always what positivity can come out, especially of adversity. You know, this is always what I find, is that in times of adversity, there is a change to transform positively. And what we want to bring with Kama is a solution that is practical, because the talking is great, you know, and with sexuality, we do a lot of talking. You know, it's the most popular content on any print magazine. We talk, but then no solutions. There's just very little out there. Even if you think of the medical professionals, there is no doctor for pleasure. You know, all of the doctor that's connected to sexuality are for reproduction. Yeah. So we've never been educated around, you know, what can we do around pleasure and how can sexuality actually help us with finding that connection and finding that growth. So Kama has that kind of function, is a practical guide with daily practices, which take you through this. And if people don't find the time and they still think that their priority is elsewhere, then they haven't connected with that potential upgrade. Mm-hmm. You know, they haven't had that realization. I think a lot of us have, a lot of people have had that waking up moment.
And the way that you communicate about karma, I find it extremely refreshing. So, you know, the way you talk about sort of consciousness and this awareness and a rebellion, arguably, against consumerism and the dependence that that brings. When you're raising money, how is that? How was that received? What, did you get some people who totally got it and other people who just could not get it? I mean, you were successful, right? I believe you raised $3 million. So can you tell us how you did that and what that process was like?
Okay, so first, I think that I've been thinking about this for a very long time. You know, it's been 15 years that I've seen I wasn't really sure what the opportunity was, but I knew that not knowing of a single brand who owns love, sex, and intimacy as a space. You know, the fact that no one could ever tell me, oh yes, when I have a question about sex, I go there. You know, and I looked and I looked and I looked and I thought how incredible it is that such a big part of our life, one that is, we know, makes money, isn't being addressed, apart from maybe, you know, a good evolution around sex toys. Certainly that's been a positive change, that you can actually get delivered, you know, sex toys to the home without having to go to one of those Soho sex shops is a massive upgrade on that level. But when it comes to, you know, just education, learning more, understanding the different cycle of life, how that's going to affect your sexuality, how it's going to affect your intimacy, there just never was anyone there. So when I went to fundraise, which, you know, I was at the time I was chief creative officer for Soho House, and I had been waiting for quite a while, going from tech summit to tech summit, asking the question, why this topic isn't on stage? We know that technology is affecting us in that way. Why are we not talking about it? And all the conversation people wanted to have was whether we're going to have sex with robots, you know, and that's sometimes how the tech community can be avoiding or ignoring the front-end issue, yeah. That they, you know, and it's other people telling you that in the future, everyone will be connected and you'll walk into a room and you'll know everything about people. I mean, do we even want that?
Yeah.
Who wants that?
That will ruin intimacy.
No one wants that. Exactly. So they're so focused on tech innovation that we're not thinking about the human condition. You know, how does that touch the human condition? So for the longest time, what happened was that because of pornography becoming vastly available and free, the community actually had put sex as a vice industry, right? So sex was added as the list of vice industry together with gambling and weed. Both of them actually are no longer vice now. And at the back of this, it was impossible for an entrepreneur to raise money because, as you know, the VCs are invested through pension funds and private equity who do not want to be associated with anything slightly edgy. Mm-hmm. So that block, which is sex, the reason we are all here, that's not the vice. Not if they should have said porn, but not, it was sex.
Yeah.
So it was very hard for anyone to come and raise money in that area. And then, of course, on top of that, the distribution platforms that we know, the places where we get our customers, the social media platform, took a very hypocritical stand on this. You know, covering the nipple doesn't make something like sexual. I would argue, actually, it's probably more sexual. And they have not taken responsibility at all to have the conversation and actually look for ways to identify the good product versus the bad product. And when they block the bad, they block the good. So the industry, for the past 15 years, 12 years, had no opportunity to better itself because as an entrepreneur with a good idea, there was no way to go and actually bring it to market. So I was waiting all that time for something to change. And about 2 years ago, sexual wellness was added as the 13th category within the wellness space. And when that happened, interestingly, because, you know, VC need a category to invest. That's the way that they think. They can't do it otherwise. It's kind of, you know, because you can't size it. If you can't size it, there's no opportunity. So sometimes it's actually quite backwards, the way that that community think about innovation and investment. So when that happened, a few businesses started to raise seed capital. You know, apps started to come to market. And when I saw this, that's when I left Soho House. And I went first fundraising in Europe. And I had very awkward meetings with VCs. So in Europe, what's really interesting, and that's something I discovered in that process, is that in Europe, the consumer is relatively more open-minded than, I would say, in the US or in the UK. They talk about sex more openly. It's almost like a non-topic because we talk about it quite a lot. You know, I'm French, so I'm very familiar with this. When it comes to the VC, however, they come usually from a very traditional, privileged, you know, kind of white background. And talking to them about sex in the boardroom was a very difficult thing because their entire life, they were told sex, work, no. Yeah, don't connect those two. So they were kind of confused. And also I learned in the past, you know, through raising money that you don't change your story based on who you talk to. That's a big mistake. So I use all the words. I use the same language. You know, I talk about everything. So I would present to them the idea and use all the vocabulary that's actually accurately, you know, referring to what I'm talking about, which is just too much for them to take. So I saw this and I thought that's interesting because I don't have a network in the US. My whole network was in Europe. But I decided to go and I went to New York, LA and San Francisco and I had completely different conversation. I had a bunch of people who understood sexual wellness, understood the wellness opportunity, but started to have, you know, they had done their research. They could see that this was obviously going to become the next big sector of focus, both from a product, and we've seen it with all those young, you know, kind of company that do lubes, that do condoms, that do tampons. You know, there's been such a really great set of initiative to create products which are talking to the people who use them, you know, and actually starting to develop smaller brands that have just a slightly different view of the market, which before that was overtaken by just four brands. You know, you only had one type of condom and two types of tampons, you know, so that's diversified. But also on the service side, you know, whether it's erotic stories, whether it's, sex education, things really started to bubble more over there. And so I was able to raise the money before I even had a team. I didn't have a product. You know, it was what we call a pre-product seed round. So very, very early stage. And I think it's because I knew my topic. Also, it helps that I have done it before. It will be different for a first-time entrepreneur, you know, of course. So there was, I just, you know, I could answer all of the questions that they were asking me, and I was very clear of the opportunity. And the great thing about what we do is common sense. Pornography is the way people are being educated around sexuality. I mean, I tell them, you have children. Don't you want something else for them to look up to? You know, don't you want an alternative model? I ask them, you know, do you think your sex life could be, improved? It's common sense. You know, a lot of it is just common sense. So when you tap into common sense in an industry that's highly commercially viable, if they're smart investors, they're going to see the opportunity.
Yeah. And I can imagine that that question is sort of quite confronting for a lot of investors to face that when you're asking, you know, do you think that your sex life could be enhanced? That's an unusual question for an investor to get, I guess. But I'm actually really surprised there where you're talking about your experience in Europe versus America. I mean, perhaps naively, I would have assumed for the reasons that you described that Europe would have been perhaps more open to this. But yeah, I guess it does depend on the demographic of the investors and the actual cultural arena within the investment space as well, not just, you know, within a country or whatnot.
I was very surprised, you know, and when I've mentioned that now, actually people realize yeah, that's actually true, but it's not something that we think. You know, we think if the consumer are open-minded, then the investment body should be similar, but it's where they come from. They come from family office, the finance world. It's a very privileged industry, you know, a VC. It's not something that a lot of people have access to. In the States, because of the nature of the economy there, there's actually just a little bit more movement. There's a lot more money invested, and they're faster. They're faster at picking up on trends.
Yeah, and Chloe, I wonder. So you were mentioning it before about your role at Soho House, and I wonder, as a former creative director, how important is branding and the creative for you in building both a company and a community around that? So, I mean, for anybody who hasn't seen Karma or engaged with Karma yet, I'm sure many of our listeners have. But I mean, you can tell that there's been a huge sort of investment, both in terms of, you know, yes, money, but sort of thought and creative in building that brand.
Well, that has been one of the magical effect of the lockdown. You know, when you are left to yourself to do exactly what you think is right, based on intuition, emotion, connection, because this is what really we want to offer, what we want to create, what we really, the ambition was to create a brand that a child could look at the Open app and feel, oh, you know, it's kind of cute. And then an older person could have this, and it would feel right for everyone. It would be inclusive. It will be playful. It will bring this sense that we are, you know, really aware that when we connect to people, you know, through something so intimate, we have to do it in a playful way. We have to do it in a mindful way. So the brand was created as an environment, and the concept behind the brand was this inner world. So everything we created were soft shapes and, you know, a representation of sexuality that's nothing to do with gender, that's nothing to do with age, that's nothing to do with sexual preferences. It's just sexuality is a world that we can explore forever in whichever direction we choose to. So it became almost like an illustrative and cartoonish, you know, opportunity to visualize a world that would make people feel safe and accepted for whatever choice that they make. And the team, and especially my creative team, you know, has benefited enormously to not have distraction, to not actually have other people contribute too much coming from the outside. And being in that bubble, creative bubble, is a totally unique way to create. And I think I've talked to quite a lot of creative during this process, and they found that their best work was done during this time. So there are a huge benefit. Creativity is something that's an inward process. So actually, in this case, it really served us. And the brand, we always, you know, my investors always say, well, we need to be, you know, product market fit. That's kind of the process we're in now. Let's meet our proposition to where the consumer's at. But what we found is that we became brand market fit super early. And it's such an amazing thing to have on your, under your belt, when people relate to your brand and they love your brand and they constantly tell you, I just love the graphic, I just love how it feels, you know, then you know you have that emotional connection. It's like you made a friend already. Now you just have to do the right thing in terms of what service you provide. But they're happy to come back into your home. They're happy to visit you, at least, because they enjoy the environment.
Yes, I can see that. And you've absolutely succeeded in what you've described there. And Chloe, I'd love to just sort of wrap up really by asking you, I mean, this isn't, you know, this isn't your first rodeo. So you were the co-founder of Made.com, which is a hugely successful business. And I wonder, how is the process of building Karma perhaps different from that? And are there any lessons that you learned from that first time around that you're consciously including as you build Karma?
So probably the most important thing that I have focused on is how to build a team. It's my experience of startups in the past has been that you are part of a kind of inertive process. You know, it's kind of growing and accelerating, and you're part of this, but you don't really control or have a time to reflect on what's happening because it's growing so quickly. And I think with this process and the past 12 months and the completely unusual dynamic in which we were able to start the business, one of the primary focus has been finding the Kama people, you know, really focusing on identifying who is a Kama person, who's a person who's not doing this because of success, personal success, not doing this because of the need for recognition, not doing this because of money, you know, which is all the questions I ask myself. So I stepped down from MED in 2015, and it's taken me all this time to feel the confidence and the acceptance for why I'm doing this. And it's not for all these reasons. You know, I want to do this because it's beyond me. I want to do this because I truly believe that my children should have a different model when it comes to the sexual experience. And so in finding people who are in that place in their career or as individual has been the most beneficial aspect of creating this business, which in the past I was totally unaware of. I was looking at CVs and, you know, aptitude. And now it's all about attitude. You know, who are you as an individual? Why are you doing this? Why does it matter to you as an individual? And how can you contribute to the team and then to the community because of your inner beliefs that this is actually what you want to do and you're going to practice and you're going to be an example for, you know, how we bring this out to the world. So that's definitely been one of the biggest learning. The other huge advantage of being a CEO, which was never my ambition. I never woke up a single day in my life and say, I want to become a CEO, right? I became a CEO because I couldn't find a co-founder that I could do this with. And I was just not going to do it otherwise. So I just went and jumped. And I'm still hoping to find partners and grow my team, you know, at exec level so that we can share the creation. I'm very, very much in favor of that. But being able to take all the decision has been quite pleasurable, you know, because I am not depending on anyone else. My investors have been relatively, supportive because of the context, you know, so I had less pressure. There was less pulling, you know, do this, do that. You have to be in this place. You have to travel and meet these people. We were really able to incubate something really special that is true, you know, to our DNA and to what we want to create. And I think that's what people are connecting to, you know, this sense of honesty behind the proposition and the product.
And are you confident, Chloe, that you can sort of continue to protect that environment as aspects of life seem to go back to normal? Do you think that's going to survive?
I mean, you know, it's something that I'm aware of. And it's something that I'm continuing to think about as I, you know, bring more people into the team. I am worried, you know, that as we know, it's what we can preserve when we're small sometimes gets diluted as we grow. I would like to be my own example for realizing that that's possible. And I think one of the things that we do think a lot about in the team is not going by models which do not work anymore. One of the big advantages of this pandemic has been that a lot of patriarchal binary models have started to collapse and the realization that they are not really suited anymore, you know, to the way we want to live. So the way, for example, you know, we don't have an org chart that's like a pyramid. You know, we have a circular system because we are actually cyclic beings, not linear beings. And we need to start thinking about a different way to organize ourselves and make decisions that is more suited to our highs and our lows, because that's just how we are designed. And that's how we relate to the environment. You know, we shouldn't always be thinking harder, faster, you know, stronger, better. Mm. That's not sustainable. That's why we're here in this kind of painful moment. So rethinking at every moment, is this really the right model for us? Even an org chart?
Yeah.
Does that even make sense? You know, and challenging those things as much as possible as we go along. Like everything, you know, the only impact we'll have in the practice that we do. So it's by doing the change ourselves, small or big, that we will eventually discover whether it's possible. But I can't tell you for sure, but it's something I think about a lot.
Mm, yeah, and it will certainly be an interesting experiment along the way.
Right, exactly. We love an experiment at Kama, that's for sure.
Well, Chloe, thank you so much for everything that you've really generously shared with us this morning. I just wonder, is there anything perhaps that we've not touched on that you'd like to pass on to our listeners or that you'd like to bring into the conversation?
No, I mean, I think the biggest message I want to get at there is that when we do take time for ourselves, and with us, we're talking about a practice around pleasure, the impact is much greater that we could even imagine. You know, we're not just talking about sexuality and connection. We're talking about our ability to become more individual and to know ourselves. And when that happens, everything changes. We make better choices and we are more likely to find peace. And when we find peace, there is that natural happiness and inner joy that can come through. And this has been my discovery, that there is so much more for us to access when we start doing that little bit of practice, even if it's 5 minutes a day.
Brilliant. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Raise the Bar. Don't forget to go to claromoney.co.uk/raise the bar to sign up for early access for Claro. Claro is a digital financial coach that helps you to make smart financial decisions and achieve your goals. If you enjoyed this episode, please do rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and spread the word. And of course, you can find us on social media at @raisehq_, and you can find all the details about our brilliant guests in the show notes. See you next week.